So, guys, tell us how the band met and formed the Gorillaz.
Oh, hang on. Hair. I've got hair in my throat there. Oh, dear, oh, dear. My head feels very sticky today. Too much ghost wine last night. I didn't know if you tried that stuff, but it's like drinking shots of washing up liquid mixed with paint stripper. Yeah? Sounds like a good idea at the time, but you do pay dearly in the morning. Anyway, right, yes, how did Gorillaz form? Well, I guess this lineup first came together around 1998, yeah, because I put loads of bands together before that. Great bands, yeah? All of them should have been enormous. What did you have? You had the Burning Sensations, Durango 95, Kiss and Make Up, Wild Willy Wally and the Wallingtons. Yeah, I was the singer in all those bands. Great stuff.
Dear Lord. Oh.
Anyway, any one of them could have been as big as Gorillaz. But, you know, eventually, I thought it might be time to try out a different vocalist, other than me.
Yeah, someone who could actually sing, maybe?
Shut it, twerp! Technically, my voice, obviously, is still much, much better than 2D's. But, yeah, I just thought it was time for a change. Change of texture. So, what happened was, I was out one day on a nicking spree. Hoisting, we call it. On the rob.
August 15th, 1997. First time we met.
Yeah, like I said, I was out robbing on a nicking spree, yeah. Right? And what I had in mind was to crash my car through the front window of this music shop. Uncle Norm's Keyboard Emporium, it was called. It was the local shop, basically, that sold all the keyboards. And what I thought was, I would just crash through the front and then steal a bunch of the keyboards, you know, and form a new band.
It was the shop I was working in.
So I crashed the car through the window and it landed straight in 2D's head. Amazing, direct hit. Knocked one of his eyes straight out. Put him in a coma immediately. I got arrested for that, yeah. And my community service, my sentence, was to look after this silly sod.
I don't know what I did wrong.
Obviously, I abused that position and took the opportunity to bully him to within an inch of his catatonic life. So, one time when we were mucking about in a car park in Nottingham, 2D actually went through the windscreen. And I think it was that second car accident that actually brought him back round. Yeah? Because it knocked his other stupid eye out. But I'll tell you what, when he stood up, wow, what an image. Tall, pretty, blue spiky hair.
No eyeballs?
No eyeballs. I knew that he had to be the front man. After that, everything sort of just fell into place. You know, I found Russell, our drummer, working in a record shop, Big Rick Black's Record Shack in Soho. Everyone had heard of Russell because he knew everything there was to know about hip-hop. He was the rhythm king. And also he was possessed by the undead, ghostly spirit of his dead friend, Del. Good drummer, too. So I kidnapped him and took him over to Kong Studios, which was our headquarters, our isolated recording studio HQ at the time.
Yeah, all we needed, right, was a guitarist. Well, we did have one, Paula Crocker.
But she was rubbish, so we advertised for another. We stuck an ad in the music paper, NME. I can't remember exactly what we wrote. I just know it stated, no hippies.
Moments later, there was a knock on the door, and there was this FedEx crate outside.
Nothing more. No one there. Just a crate.
We opened it up.
And inside was Noodle, our guitarist. We were a band. We changed our name to Gorillaz there and then, and the rest is history. Anyway, you should obviously know all this. It's all in Rise of the Ogre, the Gorillaz autobiography. Best book I've ever written. Well, only book I've ever written. Came out a couple of years ago. And do you know what? I think I'll re-release it now. Maybe even update it. It's a fantastic tale. Better than Wordsworth. It should be compulsory in schools.
I haven't even read it.
Neither have I. So, yeah. Gorillaz, that's how we formed. It's important to get a name right, though, isn't it? I had this one band called This Show Has Been Cancelled. And, well, no one ever came to see us. Pointless, really. So we split up. We did reform briefly about a month later under the name We Have Split Up. But, yeah, well, again, it was just a waste of time.
You're an idiot.
Shut your face!
And who or what are your individual musical influences, and how do they differ from the group's influences?
Oh, well, you know, it's all kind of changed now, over the years. There wasn't nearly so much of it when I was growing up.
He was born a long time ago.
I was basically into metal, you know, all kinds of metal. Hair metal, death metal, precious metal, heavy metal, scrap metal. Bands like Tigers of Pangtang, Poison, Rat, Dio, Twisted Sister, Cinderella.
I hate all that stuff. For me, it was bands like The Jam, Wire, Buzzcocks, Magazine, Ultravox, Talking Heads. I loved all the punk stuff and Human League. Scott Walker I liked.
Yeah, he's good.
Now, I don't know, it's all over the place. I get sent tapes through the post.
Tapes, really?
Yeah, tapes.
Through the post?
Yeah.
That's very odd. I didn't think they made tapes anymore. They don't email you a link or something.
No. Tapes through the post. It's Plastic Beach.
Over the years, though, my taste has changed, you know, or developed, because there's like loads of stuff. I mean, you can see it if you check out who I get to play on our albums, you know, like Ike Turner, The Far Side, De La Soul, British rappers like Bash and Kano, Roots Maneuver. Yeah.
Russell got us all into a lot of the hip-hop stuff, you know. He was into old-school stuff like ESG, Cool Herc, Trouble Funk, Sly and the Family Stone, Zap.
And I recorded some stuff with Omar Soliman over in Beirut last year. And we've obviously done loads of stuff with the National Orchestra for Arabic Music. And Cerebral Ballsy, I like. I mean, if you just want me to list stuff, I can just go Tom Tom Club, Sparks, New York Dolls, XTC, Johnny Cash, Lead Belly, Yo Majesty, Love, Kinks, Sunhouse, Tito Puente, Fotech, Cheap Trick, you know.
Salt and Pepper.
Sonic Youth, Clash, Hendrix, Quincy Jones, Scatterlights, Aphrodite's Child, The Congos, Funboy 3, Sun Ra,
Chaka Demerson,
The Sex Gang Children, Lalo Schifrin, Wendy Carlos, Augustus Pablo, Fela Kuti. Look, in one way or another, by hook or by crook, we've ended up working with loads of people that we're into. They all sort of end up in the family. Gorillaz is like a flop house for legends.
Collectively, yeah, I'd say we like cover most bases. Although Russell's been missing now for years, yeah, since we played the New York Harlem Apollo 2006.
And Noodle too. I haven't seen her since the El Manana video shoot. I had to build a cyborg out of her from the DNA I scraped up from the crash site when she got shot out of the sky. The cyborg plays a lot of guitar on the album. It came out very well. But yeah, the original Noodle, well, one can only hope that she returns. Still, I saw some footage of her with a mask on recently. It got used, actually, in our Melancholy Hill video, so I think she's safe. She might even be on her way back to us, to Plastic Beach. Yeah, who knows?
So, guys, how did you both begin playing music, and what was your first musical instrument?
For me, it was keyboards, any keyboards, really. Like, my dad used to find stuff in junk shops and even customise them for me. I had a Casio VL Tone, which I used to take everywhere with me. It looks a bit like a melodica, which was another instrument I loved, still do. But, you know, keyboards was the thing that I love. Stylophones, Moog, synths, electronic stuff. Anything that makes a bloopy noise. I was a bit like Brian Eno.
Only without the talent. Or brains.
Sod off your guff.
Right, that's it. Yes. Now, where were we? Oh, yeah, instruments. Well, everyone knows that bass is best. Yeah? It's heavy, sexy, and you can rattle the bowels of the earth with it. The one I use today is named El Diablo. It was given to me by Beelzebub, the king of the underworld himself, as a present, when I signed my eternal contract with him. I gave him my soul, and he promised to make Gorillaz the biggest band that the world has ever seen. So, yeah, it's all working out rather nicely, really, isn't it?
Although you can't really play it, so we keep having to bring in extra bass players.
Now, Murdoch, it's been known that you've developed some issues with 2D over the years. How do you create music with 2D if you can't even stand to be near him? Your bio in the Gorillaz website states that you hate 2D... And 2D also idolises you, Murdoch. So, tell me, Tell me a bit about that.
Well, I admit it's not all plain sailing. I mean, look at him. He's got, well, special needs. But for me, you know, music is the ultimate goal. Something that you have to rise above petty differences in order to achieve. You know, the greater good. And he does have a very special voice. Voice of an angle.
You can't do it without me, simple as that. You'd still be living in a Winnebago in Stoke if I wasn't singing. Knocking off barmaids on a Friday night, if you were lucky.
And even if it is like dealing with some form of mental case, I still think it's worth it, in the end. And I guess it helps that he's always looked up to me as a kind of father figure.
In your dreams, Pedro.
And also, I understand it's not very gentlemanly to point out that our first guitarist, the one before Noodle, was a girl called Paula Cracker. She was 2D's girlfriend, who I had a rather lovely altercation with in the toilets at Kong Studios.
Wait, after! No! No, you don't pull that! Ow! For the love of...
Sit back down. That's it, like a good boy. And let's finish this interview, shall we? Just breathe into this rag. Yeah, deep breaths, big gulps. Yeah, there we go. All better now. Shall we continue? And, you know, I think it might be a good idea to direct the next question at me, not him.
And 2D, you were introduced to the Free Tibet campaign by Adam Yaut from the Beastie Boys and have been an avid supporter of the Free Tibet campaign ever since. Describe what this campaign means to you and how you hope to raise awareness with your music.
Don't ask him anything serious. I mean, you just get a load of rubbish falling out of his trap.
Yeah, the Free Tibet campaign was something that a lot of people threw their weight behind. I mean, I think it's important to lend your position to...
But you've got to ask yourself, haven't you? Yeah. I mean, how much trouble are these people in if they need 2D? Yeah. An animated singer from a Western pop band as a spokesperson for their cause?
I think it's important for each and every person to have the liberty and the freedom to live their lives how they choose to, without the interjection and repression from heavy-handed authorities. It's about basic human rights, really.
He doesn't really know what he's talking about, though. Do bear that in mind.
You know what, guys? I've always loved the song Clint Eastwood, but could never figure out what it's about. What is the song about? I mean, what inspired the song's title?
Oh, you know, melancholy, hope, and sweet, sweet dubby reggae. That was one of the first tracks I wrote for this band. Instant hit. You know, it's all built up around my deep, twangy bass. That and a little button marked reggae setting on my Honda Z-chord hit-making machine.
With the lyrics. Well, it's not actual sunshine. You know, I don't have sunshine in an actual bag, you know. I'm not even sure that's possible. I'd have to check with someone like Stephen Hawkins on that. I did have a bag, though, but it wasn't actually sunshine inside the bag. It was some old gym clothes and some shoes and a paperback.
Oh, we finished the track off at G-Jam Studios in Jamaica in about April, May 2000. Blimey, that was over 10 years ago now. And that track's still a monster. It's actually like a big, clean, inky canvas for rappers of all sizes to come paint their rhymes onto. That one's had raps by Del the Ghost Rapper, Cyan Life from Phi Life Cypher, Tiny Temper's had a crack at it, Snoop Dogg at Glastonbury, Bashir Kano did a version, and Eslam Jawad threw his set into the mix recently in Syria and Damascus at this show we did at the Citadel. It's a truly continental cut, that Clint Eastwood song. Frequent flyer.
We called it Clint Eastwood because it had a kind of Ennio Morricone feel to the melodica line, like the good, the bad and the ugly or something. So we went with that as a theme. And also calling it Clint Eastwood had a kind of old reggae vibe to the name.
I'm not sure why you're actually still talking here. I mean, you had nothing to do with that track other than singing my lyrics.
The version that the Gorillaz live band are now doing is great. Very heavy, you know. Paul Simon's bass is way better, way heavier than the original now. In fact, we should record it with the proper bass on there instead of that cod ham-fisted clumping you do.
Dirty Harry focuses on a war in the Middle East, yeah, and features the children's choir of San Fernandes. What are the song's meanings, and how did the addition of the children's choir affect the song's themes?
This is one of the first ones Noodle made with Danger Mouse, who took the production wheel for Demon Days, our enormous selling second album. It was built up around an old Gorillaz jam.
Russell wanted the drums to sound like something Clyde Stubblefield would put down, or Zigaboo Modelise from the Meters. Instead of just sampling a breakbeat, he'd try and make a beat that people would have sampled from the original hip-hop era.
Then we sampled it, cut it up, and made it sound like a breakbeat. Bit pointless, really, but we were jamming round a keyboard riff that sounded something like The Message by Grandmaster Flash.
Danger Mouse added the San Fernandes Youth Chorus.
I think it's always quite powerful when you get kiddywinks singing along to serious themes, don't you? I think it's right, though, isn't it? You know, children are our future, huh? If you infect them when they're young, you can usually keep them for life.
These kids are growing up out of a climate of conflict where intolerance has been encouraged and there's a sense of fighting for something you're being manipulated into backing. It can't be good in the long run.
All you can really do as a musician is try and offer a different view, something a little more conciliatory.
So Booty Brown from the far side skids into the middle of the track and just like unleashes his machine gun peace rap, you know? Booty's rap humanises the position of the soldier, the fighter as an individual.
You add the Arabic strings into the mix of them and then you got the whole picture. It's a handshake from both sides. A bigger overview. I think it's time for a quick Almazza, don't you? The name, though, yeah. I think you're reading too much into it. The song we did, Clint Eastwood, came first, and we needed another hit like Clint Eastwood. So we named the track Dirty Harry, which is a bit like Clint Eastwood. It's only when you look back on it, it seems to have that political connection. Actually, have you got any rum? I'm beginning to come round, and it's not a pleasant feeling, I can tell you, being in focus. Please.
Now, one of my favourites, Feel Good Inc., was awarded the Grammy Award for Best Pop Collaboration with Vocals in 2005. Did you feel this song was going to be a major hit when you were recording it with De La Soul?
Yeah, Feel Good Inc., yeah. I saw its potential from the very first beat. It was like panning for gold amongst the brown, murky waters. I saw this track all shiny and glimmery, shining like a big rock of gold. It said, play me, play me. And I knew as soon as the De La Soul boys dropped their glorious rap about Motowns and ghost towns, this one was going to explode.
Against my melody bit, the raps, they, like, really take off.
I think the De La Soul boys had been mucking about with canisters of nitrous oxide all morning because, to be frank, you know, they were giggling their backsides off when they came in.
It looked like they were going to out-cartoon us, you know? Lyric-wise, the first part of this came from when I was passing the wind turbines out near Palm Springs. I think I was going to the Coachella Festival and I passed, like, a huge field full of those wind turbines farming the land. So I started really with the chorus section and, you know, built it up from there. Windmill, farm the land, turn forever handy hand.
So let's touch on a more serious note, guys. Kids with guns. I mean, it focuses, you know, on a very serious issue. And the chorus reads, and they're turning us into monsters, turning us into fire, turning us into monsters, it's all desire. And the music complements the lyrics with a temperamental and emotional vibe. Discuss what methods you used to create the music and lyrics that gave off this feeling.
I got all cold and metallic like I was having a big math come down. It seems to do the job, though. Look, the only point I was trying to put across is that in order to fight monsters, right, you have to become a monster of some sort yourself. Take out all the little soft, fluffy bits and become a bit empty. Turning us into monsters, yeah? Just dead, lifeless eyes staring down the barrel of a gun. Kids, eh? Don't you just love them?
You know when you send people into battle, you have to turn them into a certain kind of thing that can go out and potentially kill. Anyway, maybe it's not good to be too specific, but when you, you know...
It's a strong image, isn't it? Kids with guns. Like that picture by William Klein, Gun One. Check it out. The kid's got a lovely screwed-up face and the gun's pointing right into the camera. Gorgeous. It's only a picture, though.
We were joined on this track by Leonard Cherry. Yeah, All Like Sushi was another album that I loved when growing up.
And on your new album, Plastic Beach, you work with Snoop Dogg, Lou Reed, Bashy, Mos Def, De La Soul, Gruff Reese, Mick Jones and Paul Simonon, to name a few. I mean, the list goes on, doesn't it? I mean, what are some of the interesting stories you have that occurred when you were creating the album with these amazing musicians?
Oh, I got loads. I mean, how could you not when you've taken so many of those legends, put them together and brought them out to Plastic Beach? Legends of punk, legends of soul, new UK grime rappers, talents old and new. It's like a catalyst for a big adventure, isn't it? Actually, you should have seen some of the poker games we had, you know? Some of them lasted 4 or 5 nights.
Obviously, I had to work all around this mess. Plastic Beach became like the Stones' place when they recorded Exile on Main Street. It's just ours, instead of being like a sunk-kissed mansion in the south of France, was a floating piece of garbage in the middle of the Pacific.
Working with Snoop was great. Out of the green, eerie fog that surrounds Plastic Beach, this silhouette of pimp fur and French braids just loomed in. He took a look around the joint and just kind of, welcome to the world of Plastic Beach. Exhale. And after a brief bit of crack-a-lacking in the bubble bath, we were up and running. With White Flag, Bashy and Kano came out to Plastic Beach, and their first reactions were recorded live as they hit the shores. Those lyrics, those raps, were literally the first words those two spoke. I brought them over to Plastic Beach via a crate, so they didn't know exactly where they were or what to expect. See, I crowbarred open the crate, and as they set foot on the jetty, I shoved a mic into their faces and recorded the reaction into my silly little tape recorder. Ta-da! Never a truer rap spoken.
Although the National Orchestra for Arabic Music was recorded differently, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, faceache, that's true. For that, I actually had to go to Syria. I was in disguise as so many people were actually trying to kill me. I was dressed up in this sort of big smock. It was a bit sort of Peter Sellers, but, you know, needs must, if you know what I'm saying. So I got over there and I worked with a guy named Essam Rafea, brilliant conductor, who conducted the Syrian orchestra, which you can hear at the beginning of White Flag. Since then, when Gorillaz play live, the Syrian orchestra have joined us in one form or another. And, of course, Gorillaz went over there to play a concert in July. The first major Western band to ever perform there, which is another small step for mankind.
Stylo, the song featuring hip-hop artist Mos Def and funk musician Bobby Womack, contains a lot of heavy vocal solos and interesting electronic instrumentation. Describe the experience you had in the studio when you first recorded this track.
Stylo. Yeah, this was the first single to come off the album. In fact, this one got stolen just weeks before the release. Some pirate shot up my island and nicked it and then leaked it online. You can't plug holes like that anymore in the brave new digital world. This is a new sound for Gorillaz, an electro-ish crack funk sound with a little bit of politics and a whole lot of soul going down. With Stylo, I wanted the music to feel euphoric whilst still putting across how precarious, how tightly packed situation is now worldwide. Where we're at as a species on this overpopulated planet, coming on to the overload. Can you feel it, kids? Can you feel it, eh? The funny thing is, since man could pick up a pen and put his thoughts on paper, we've always had a sense of the apocalyptic, imminent doomsday. But, you know, yeah, I think something's got to give. It's like rubbing the impossible to burst. I think you can hear that in Bobby Womack's chorus. He just explodes into the track. I mean, how good is it to get Bobby Womack on the record? And now on tour with Gorillaz. That was the first recording he's made in, what, 15, 20 years? So what an honour for him. Only joking. So the vocals for this were recorded out in New York. Same time that I hooked up with Mos Def. Yeah, he's great. Great rapper, great actor, and really vibrant presence. Him and Bobby worked really well with 2D here, so the whole track came together. When I first met up with Mose, it was at the Box Club in New York. He wouldn't stop yapping about the boogeyman. I thought it was just the cocktails talking. But Mose said he's a dark entity, yeah? Made up of all the evil in the world. Swirling black shadow with a gas mask for a face. He's a war unto himself. I shrugged and let Mose spill all this out. But I didn't really take it in. I just wanted Mose on the album, so I put up with it. Turns out that Mose was right. We've got the boogeyman on film now. I'm definitely looking over my shoulder more often. No doubt that's another battle I'm going to end up having. In fact, I tell you where you can see the boogeyman. He turns up in the footage we use for the Stylo video. It's enough to send a chill right down your spine. Look, why don't you top my glass up, stick the record on, and we'll have a little listen, eh? How about that?
Your video for Stylo features Bruce Willis as a bounty hunter. Can you summarise the video for us? You know, what was it like to work with Bruce Willis?
Yeah, I can summarise it. Someone hired Bruce Willis, or some kind of Willis looky-likey, to try and blow my brains out in the desert. Swine. I had some camera crew following me around, you know, some guys I'd hired, and they caught the whole thing on camera. Quite well, I thought.
I was next to Murdoch, who was driving. I was, like, really, really, really hungover that day. I remember I was using this kind of clown mask to hide my headache. It didn't really work.
And we had Cyborg Noodle in the back. We were minding our own business, tearing through the desert in the black Stylo Camaro. All of a sudden, I noticed I was being trailed by this cop car. Next thing, Cyborg goes mental and starts shooting at the cop. I tried to pull her in, but it didn't work. The cop flew off the road, and then we launched into this massive billboard, at which point Cyborg started having some sort of digital fit. Next thing, this red car pulls up alongside with Bruce Willis in it. And he's taking pot shots at us.
I always thought you two got on.
Yeah, me too. Maybe he's just got a grump on, you know, because I stiffed him with that sake bill at Nobu that time. But, you know, boy, that's a bit traumatic to hunt me down and try and kill me. Eventually, just to escape this nut, I had to drive the car off a cliff, straight into the sea.
Is this a dream you had?
No, you fool. You were there too, don't you remember? Anyway, I was so traumatised by all this that my therapist told me to try and turn it into a positive experience. So I used the footage to make a video for our Stylo single. It's all up there on the World Wide Web. Check it out. You won't see anything finer, you know.
Damon Albarn and Jamie Hewlett served as the producers for Plastic Beach. What kinds of methods and techniques did they use when they helped you create the album?
A lot of channeling. You see, in my dotage, I have come to realise that I'm not 100% sure I truly exist. I may, just may, mind you, be born and thrust forth out of the collective minds of those two horrors. It doesn't make me any less real, but they did give me substance. Or substances. I'm not sure. This interview's dragging on a bit, isn't it? Can we sort of pick up the pace a bit?
I think Glitter Freeze is one of the most interesting tracks on Plastic Beach. I mean, it's filled with loud electronic synthesizers, features Marky Smith from The Fall on vocals. What was going through your minds when you created the song?
Rum, Rohypnol, something exotic from the Navajo Nation, little tinctures and technicolor images of huge ships crashing in dirty, broken waves. The roar of the ocean smashing into angry, howling boats. Black, harrowing gales spitting hurricanes against the shore. With all the chaos and madness being conducted by a toothless, barking pirate named Marky Smith from The Fall. That was going through my mind. It's my version of Fantasia, or maybe some mad old naval painting. It's kind of effective, don't you think?
Marky Smith tried to ram raid our island, Plastic Beach. He sailed in on the ghostly pirate ship and tried to smash his way into the recording room.
It's a bit chemically synthetic glam rock stomp set on a boat. Do you like it? Do you? I think what the breakdown needs, though, is a great big air raid siren creaming its way into the middle to let you know that there's danger coming your way.
We did a few different versions of this, actually. There's one when I'm humming all the way through, which sounded good. I wonder why we didn't use that one. Yeah, all right! Damn it!
Yeah, I wonder too. A track with you humming all the way through. Can't think why we wouldn't have used that.
On Melancholy Hill, the video that contains computer-animated graphics with additional plastic-looking images, I mean, how was this accomplished and how much planning did it take to create this unique music video?
I don't know what you're talking about. It's just us in the video.
Well, it's a little more than that, you dollop. This is one of Jamie's, yeah? Jamie Hewlett's ideas. He filmed us from where the Stylo video ended. It takes off from that point. So we're still in the shark submarine, travelling towards what for the viewer is an unknown destination. See, I know we're headed over to Plastic Beach.
That's when the cyborg noodle went and coughed up that octopus. That frightened the life out of me.
If only. Anyway, this is where it gets good. I spotted this lump of rock, you know, this outcrop in the ocean with this manatee sunbathing on it. I'm not sure exactly what I had taken that day, but the visuals were really strong. I started heading for the manatee in my snazzy little submarine. And then in the video, you can see we got some serious backup, you know. We've joined by a host of other submarines in all shapes and sizes, all travelling to the same destination with me. And in the subs, guess who? My pals from the album. Lou Reed, Griff Rhys, Snoop Dogg, Paul Simonon, Mick Jones and De La Soul. The boys. But then, you know, it gets a bit darker. We can see that the manatee's covered in barbed wire and it's the boogeyman trying to take the poor creature down under into the murky depths of the ocean. So, yeah, Melancholy Hill. That's a place on the island. The Melancholy Hill of Plastic Beach. It's that feeling, that place that you get in your soul sometimes, like someone's let your tyres down, yeah? A bit deflated. I usually get that around Tuesday morning. Clears up again maybe Thursday and I'm ready to start all over again. But it always seems quite real when I'm going through it.
I only really joined the band to make music and now I'm being held captive by a bastard bass player in an underwater submarine being attacked by sodding pirates who are trying to take over this rotten piece of broken plastic in the ocean that gorillas call home. All this just to make a video. It's making me want to die.
But okay, yeah. Despite the obvious trauma involved, this has to be the best Gorillaz video yet. A noodle, the real noodle's back. I don't know where she is, but this footage shows her being shot at and then escaping into a lifeboat. It's definitely her, though. And Russell's in it, too. I don't know what he's been eating, but he is giant. Giant!
Your music videos tend to have a heavy amount of digital production and computer-generated graphics. So how did you begin to create these videos and what methods and technologies did you use to create them?
Ah, there's a variety of methods. Sometimes I just get our video director of choice, Jamie Hewlett, and say, look, this is the idea, OK? Other times he's had a listen to the track and he'll sketch a couple of ideas out. Sometimes we'll meet up and talk about it. Sometimes. I might mime the video out and then kind of email him in a link. One time I got inside a box and mailed myself to him. It's always different. Once we film the basic premise, you know, all synced up to the track, right, we'll send it over to the Oompa Loompas at Passion Pictures and they'll get to work in their little underground mines, adding effects and extras, just to give them the extra wow factors.
So, what goals do you have for Plastic Beach, guys? I mean, what do you hope your fans will get out of this new and amazing album?
Goals? We've already done it. Plastic Beach is the document. That's the evidence. The third part of the trilogy. The third panel in my triptych. Look, I've said it before, but all this is, you know, is a drawing, a sketch. Plastic Beach, the rotting dump in the ocean, is our home for now. But the album is a picture postcard from here. A postcard from the edge of the world. From way back where you are, it might look like luxury, yeah? But as you get closer, you'll see it for what it is. A horrible lump of plastic that's been painted pink. It's a fake luxury, yeah? Transparent. So maybe it's, I don't know, a warning or a message that maybe we shouldn't turn our world into a spray-painted skip, you know? But other goals, I don't know. I would like to play one of these Gorillaz concerts that's been cropping up. You know, it's quite possible that what happened all those years ago is that Damon Albarn and Jamie Hewlett conjured us, Gorillaz, up. Four mad separate characters now made flesh. And now it seems they seem to be having quite a hard time trying to stick us back in the lamp. Boo-hoo. We're here now, and not even with the Clashers back up are you going to defeat us. I'm more than happy to go to war with those goons. For real. I've been denied entrance to my stage many, many times now by those ego-grabbing charlatans. But I'm coming back, see? And blood will spill. How's that for drama?
And is there anything else that you'd want to tell your fans about the new album, Plastic Beach?
Yeah. Well, it might just be the missing part of the jigsaw. Real fans will know what I'm talking about, you know? Oh, and yeah, there's one other thing. Plastic Beach, this place I'm on, I think there's something very odd happening here. You see, I just noticed, and it's easy enough to point out, that since the beginning of time, each leap of evolution and innovation has taken a shorter and shorter amount of time. The universe was created 14 billion years ago. Earth, 4.5 billion years. Man arrived in its earliest state about 4.5 million years ago. And then we evolved into this state, Homo sapiens, around 200,000 years ago. The earliest cities appeared about 6,000 to 7,000 years ago over in Mesopotamia. And then we've been at war ever since, really. Right up to the last 100 years. And then we really kicked off. Population of the planet had gone from 1 billion to 7 billion in the last 100 years. And every single piece of digital information and technology has exploded in this last century. We're crammed, packed, and it's getting more and more, escalating. The overload. Humanity is now squeezed into this tiny plastic bubble. Everything getting faster and faster, whirling towards an inevitable conclusion. A single point on the horizon, or in the middle of the ocean, say. The entire of time and history and evolution is hurtling towards a single point. Point Nemo. Plastic Beach. That's what Plastic Beach is, I reckon. The end of days. The point of no return. It's right here. It's right now. It's upon us. The future has finally come on. Today. Does that make sense? Yeah? Great. Right, I'm off for a tinkle. Great talking to you. Come on, 2D. Let's grab a quick sharpener. Last one at the bar's on.
Thank you, and good night.